Welcome to Ad Exchanger Talks, the podcast devoted to examining the issues and trends in advertising and marketing technology that matter most to you.
This episode is brought to you by Telium, providers of the universal data hub that enables organizations to orchestrate customer data across their data supply chain. Stay tuned to hear from Telium's VP Solutions, Chris Slovak, as he talks to AdExchanger about ensuring data quality and connecting customer identities.
Hello, listener. Welcome back to another episode of AdExchanger Talks. My name is Zach Rogers. I'm the executive editor of AdExchanger. And since we started this podcast something like 88 weeks ago, we've had a lot of CEOs who founded programmatic platform businesses, 8, 9, 10 years ago. But we haven't had all of them. And my guest in the studio is one of them, and I'm pleased to have him here. He is Tim Cadogan, the founding and still current CEO of OpenX, which is, one of the original exchange platforms dating back to 2008. I guess that makes you guys 10 years old.
It does, yeah. Hi, Zach. Great
Hello.
To be here.
Yes. Welcome. It's good to have you.
We did just, your timing's right on. We just celebrated our 10-year anniversary.
Happy birthday.
In May.
Yeah, so, great.
Yeah, quite a thing. Quite an amazing journey to think about, not just for us, for the space. And of course, you guys have been covering it for all of that as well.
So. Yes, I feel old.
Yeah, a little bit. I know what you mean.
So we're going to talk about those 10 years and what's changed in the digital marketing and media industries.
Very little.
What has stayed the same?
Yeah.
Very little. Tim is also on the board of Axiom. We probably won't be talking about Axiom a heck of a lot. Just in light of the process the company's been running around the sale of its assets.
Yep.
So maybe we could start out with just a little discussion of you personally.
Sure,
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in a rural part of England called Dorset, which is on the south coast. It's very pretty. Mm-hmm. It's very quiet. It's farmland and coastline. And
what did your parents do?
Teachers.
Okay.
And, as with anyone or most people who grew up in a small town and they want to move to the big city, so went to university in London and
you couldn't get out of there fast enough.
Yeah, it's funny though, when nowadays when you go back, you it's like all things, the grass is always greener. You go back and you're like, wow, this is really beautiful. But there's not a lot of great jobs, and it's quiet and steady. A good place to hang out and go on vacation. But
do you still go back there?
Yeah, we go back once or twice a year.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Terrific.
Yeah.
You went to university in London.
Yeah, London School of Economics, undergrad, Oxford, postgrad.
Okay, you were a serious achiever even then.
I spent too much time in education. But and then I finally came to the U.S. to go to Stanford, to go to business school. And came in 96, which of course was, right when the internet was really beginning to take off. So I was in Silicon Valley 96 to 98 in school. And, it became obvious that this was a pretty exciting period.
Right. In the internet.
The internet, right. The beginning of a lot of things. And so that sucked me in.
So you emerged from your education with this amazing pedigree, Oxford, Stanford. And a plan to build a career in.
Not a great plan.
In the internet world, what was your idea?
I pursued the path of a lot of folks who don't necessarily have a super clear plan. So I went to Boston Consulting Group, which is a great job. BCG, McKinsey, any of those, you get exposure to a lot of different industries, and if you do reasonably well in those days, and I think still today they'll back you up to go to business school. That for me was a two-part experiment. Like one, to come to the U.S. and to see if I liked that. Mm-hmm. And two, to, get exposed to more people and to see what was going on. And then, I didn't know that the internet was going to take off right around that time frame, but it did.
Yeah.
And that led me to becoming a product manager at GoTo, which became Overture, which was the company that invented the paid search business model.
Yes.
And so we had an amazing experience there, all of us who worked there. And that led me to Yahoo. Yahoo hired me to help run their search business.
Right. one of the great sort of battles of the titans in the early internet days.
My word, yeah. Like, we were going at it hammer and tongs on, you know, the search engine wars, which, of course, we lost, right?
Yes, you did. I'm sorry about that.
Yeah, it was painful, but we lost it and had to recognize that. And kind of leading up to OpenX, what I ended up doing at Yahoo was running the product side for search and display. And what was striking was that search, this is now 2007, 2008, search was an efficient, high-scale business that worked very well, really for almost everybody, consumer, owner of the inventory, and the advertiser. And display was pretty inefficient, right? We'd bought a company called Right Media, the first exchange, and we were starting to make some progress thinking about how do you get display, as it was then known, to be more efficient and be more effective and to scale and work more effectively for all the participants. And so you could see the beginnings of some new ways of being able to do business. Then took on OpenX, which was an open source project. It was a very small company built around an open source ad server. And our idea, and my co-founder and I had a pretty simple idea at the beginning, which was let's take...
Wait, so this is the year 2008. So you were with Yahoo for a good...
5 years.
Okay, five years.
Four good years, one more painful one.
Okay, got it.
As things sort of really started to slide. And the genesis of OpenX was, hey, look, we realized that you were beginning to be able to transact in real time. And you were beginning to be able to use consumer data at the atomic level, right? The level of the impression to access that data in real time and potentially trade on it. And so our idea was let's build a marketplace, but let's build it in true real time, not proxy bidding, which is where you put in your bids and then they're acted upon later, but true real time system. And the idea was, hey, let's take this open source footprint of publishers. We had 30,000 publishers using the code as our sort of starter kit to get supply, because it's always difficult to get supply and demand. You got to go out and do business development and so on. We thought, hey, this would give us a faster on-ramp to a critical mass of supply that we can build this real-time bidded marketplace upon. Now, like all great plans, didn't work out quite that well because a lot of the open source supply wasn't that great. And we had early quality problems and some of them didn't want to participate and so on. So we ended up doing it the hard way and building up our supply and our demand through, you know, spit shoe polish.
Human relationships.
Human relationships, going out, you know, and building the business by hook or by crook.
Okay, great. And the rest is history, so to speak. The company is, as we've said, 10 years old.
Yep.
A lot has changed for media companies, publishers, in those 10 years. I mean, big picture question. How have you responded to those changes over time, and how is your what's your strategic direction? How is it different now?
Well, here's what's kind of many things have changed, but some fundamentals haven't changed.
What hasn't changed?
Publishers are still trying to make more money out of their audience. That hasn't changed. I don't think it ever will change.
Right.
And advertisers are still trying to reach their consumers in an ever more effective way to drive sales. Right. Those two things are sort of permanent principles. What has changed is the tactics and mechanics of how those two things come together have gotten a lot more multifaceted and intricate, and in some cases complicated.
Right.
For publishers, for example, there are now many more options. Right. They have more complexity to deal with because they have more screens. They're probably in mobile web. They're in desktop web, traditional web. They may have an app. They've got more issues to think about from that point of view, and they have more options. Right? They have, and so they have a lot more technology choices and partners to sift through.
Right.
And the same thing is true for the buy side. In fact, I just came, we had a event where we hosted about 20 big brands who've become very interested in trying to understand the supply side of the world. As you know, you've been covering it. So this is our first event to kind of educate them and also learn from them what's important to them. And what was very striking is how incredibly complicated it is for them to understand what it is that's going on all the way through the value chain. The same is true of publishers. So I think one big change is that you have more choices, but also with that comes a lot more complexity. And that leads, I think, all of the principals to be thinking very carefully about who do I want to partner with? Because I need a partner in, whether it's a DSP or an exchange on the supply side, who can help me navigate this complexity, which isn't going away. It's only accelerating, right? As we add connected TV and other forms of media consumption to the mix. So it's getting super interesting, but it is complicated and people need good partners to navigate that.
Great. And that's where you come in.
Yeah.
One of the sort of things that surfaced its head repeatedly over those 10 years is attempts by sort of bad actors to exploit the programmatic pipes.
Yes.
And then the big one people will think of is non-human traffic and how that kind of reared its head in about 2012, 13 as a real problem and maybe a larger problem than any of the exchange platforms even knew.
Well, we had some – so look, any business, any industry that makes money has people who try and exploit it. It's true for every category across the whole economy. So it's not – it's never a surprise, right? If there's money, someone is going to, you know, criminals are going to try and find a way of taking what you have. If you run a general contractor business and you run a site here in New York City, you got to put a fence around it.
Right.
Because people want to steal your stuff.
Right.
It's human nature, unfortunately. In our case, because I, Jason, some of the other team had experience in the search business, we'd kind of lived this before. So in the search business, it was click-through fraud. Right. In this business, in programmatic, it's impression fraud, right? Predominantly. And one of the interesting things that we saw is that as search fraud became harder to perpetrate, as Google, Bing, Yahoo, and others really, really tightened up, a lot of those bad actors moved into this new market because they could use some of their techniques and modify them and saw that there was an opportunity there. And so we invested very, very early. We brought over a guy called John Murphy, who I think you guys have certainly interviewed, who was one of the key guys running the search anti-fraud team at Yahoo. He came in nearly 6 years ago now to help set up our marketplace integrity function and to try and deal with all this stuff. So we got on top of it really early. I'd probably say one of the earliest. And have been battling it ever since. And it is a never-ending battle. Right? Just as you will talk to a credit card company, like they're never going to stop combating credit card fraud. You name it. So it's an ongoing battle and something that we invest a lot in. I mean, we talked about it publicly. We'll invest probably about $25 million this year in combating quality. And we have about 30 people who work on it, and that's engineering, policy, and enforcement. So it's a big effort.
That's a major expense.
It is. But
do you think the buyers appreciate the money you put into that?
I think they do. And one of the things when they know about it, so that's the key, and something that we I think are beginning to do a better job of is just telling people what we're doing and all the different aspects of quality. And non-human traffic is one and very, very, an existential problem, right? It's vital that you address that. But you've also got to address brand safety. You've got to address ad quality. You've got to address ad placement. For example, you can have human traffic on a site that has 25 ads all over the place. That's a terrible experience for the advertiser, even though it's human traffic.
Yes, right.
So there's a whole sort of set of dimensions around quality, and we try and make sure that we work on all of
those. It seems like there's a lot of work you have to do to just keep all of the publishers using your platform in line to some extent. Like the domain spoofing thing was another one where it's like, it's largely been, I think, solved by ads.txt.
Ads.txt has been huge, like really helped with that problem. But
it seems like there are other situations where publishers are sort of skimping a little bit on the information they provide to you and your buyers in a way.
Well, we do a couple of things. So whenever someone wants to work with us, we do an evaluation of their business up front before they get into the marketplace. And we work out, some of the most fundamental things are how they're getting their traffic. If someone's a heavy buyer of traffic that doesn't have a lot of organic traffic to their site, then, that's a flag, right? Because once you start traffic buying, even if you don't intend to, you can put yourself at risk as a publisher. So we evaluate that. Once they pass all our checks and we let them into the marketplace, then we're evaluating them using the real-time technology that we built and iterated on. But we're also doing retroactive scrubs. Every week we're going through and looking for, did we miss anything? And we're also listening to the DSPs who report back to us on behalf of the clients. Is there anything that you guys saw? And we have fraud-free guarantees in place with most of the big DSPs. So this sort of multifaceted set of approaches. And that we're using and working with WideOps, IAS, and Moat to help check our work, basically check our homework from a fraud point of view, from a view of it, done from a viewability point of view.
So you've done a lot of work integrating with these partners who are outside sort of measurement firms.
Absolutely,
that help ensure quality. Do you think you're seeing an upside there, or was it mostly expense at this point?
No, it's definitely been...
Is there an increase in spend that you can associate? Or
we definitely have seen that. Now, at this point, we've been doing this for years, so I think it goes back a little while. But it also helps with, in terms of... They're a little bit more qualitative, but reputation and credibility in the marketplace. I think we do feel that people, when they talk to us, like, I know you guys, I know you stand for quality, I know that I can trust what you're doing. And, you know, we talked about 10 years, right? We have been and we are in this business for the long term because we think it's a really important category. And so we're trying to make sure that we do a good job and that we, by doing that and together with some of our colleagues in the space, we create a marketplace that can be as big as its full potential. And, and, you know, to go to first principles, we think that technology-based trading of advertising, programmatic in other words, is going to be the default transaction model for advertising around the world. More people are consuming their media digitally. They're consuming it in a greater, very wide range of ways, and that's only going to increase. And the only way you can present relevant advertising at scale across many screens, formats, and countries is using technology. So we need the buyers and the sellers to be able to completely trust the system.
We're going to hear from a sponsor. Take a quick break. We'll be right back with Tim. Hi, I'm back with Chris Slovak, VP of Solutions at our sponsor, Telium. Chris, what will a marketing stack look like 5 years from now?
Yeah, so this is my favorite question. I actually asked all my employees it when they interview. I think it's going to be hard to put a kind of crystal ball on this, but I will say that change is the only constant. We went from 1,000 vendors to 6,800 in just the last 4 years. It means that marketers and technology providers need to have openness around their platforms. We have to be API driven. We have to exchange data. Clearly, there's a lot going on when it comes to machine learning, which means that the quality of data is really going to be key. And we believe that you need to have a platform as a business that enables you to manage that.
So there's a lot of conversation around identity resolution. How does Telium do that?
So part of your sort of core infrastructure, if you will, is going to have to be this idea of figuring out who people are. And identity resolution is the practice of figuring out who somebody is from anonymous through their journey to being known, right, and everything in between. We use a model called deterministic matching. The reason we do that is we think accuracy is really critical when it comes to data. So what we want to do is make sure that before we merge people together or create that identity, we're absolutely certain. We think getting the wrong message in front of somebody is much worse than, you know, just having a good core message.
So with new privacy legislation, there are a lot of conversations about how companies are going to be able to use third-party data. What are you hearing? What are your thoughts on that?
I mean, it's definitely been a staple of the industry for a long, long time. But I think that we've overlooked first-party data. It's so critical because it's what you actually know about your customer, and it's something that only you as a brand has, and it's really a competitive advantage. Third-party data is going to come under more scrutiny because of sort of the new regulations around consent and transparency. I think that might, you know, impact its accuracy and availability over time. But it'll kind of be interesting to see how that goes forward. We think brands really need to focus on their first-party data as a start, though.
All right, good stuff. Thanks so much, Chris and Telium. All right, and I'm back with Tim Cadogan from OpenX. We're talking about the last decade in programmatic and what's changed. You know, when I think of the competitive set that you're part of, the SSP exchange category, and how it emerged to solve what could be described as a 10 years ago problem, ad network mediation, a problem that doesn't exist anymore. And yet here you still are.
Well, that's a really interesting point, actually. I'm super glad you brought that up because we had a, this is what, another one of our theories. So we started with a real-time marketplace. We didn't have what was then called an SSP. I should just address this. Like today, I think we think, and I think most people think an SSP and exchange pretty much means the same thing. When we started, we were an exchange, which we denoted as we do real-time bidding. We did not do ad network mediation. And our theory was that's probably because, you know, ad networks will go away. So we should focus on the future and not spend too much time on the ad network side.
Okay.
So we were kind of right and wrong, right? We were right in that they, particularly in the display market, generally have gone away, except in very specialized areas. But it took longer than we expected. And so we ended up offering SSP functionality in about 2012, where we could combine the real-time bidding with ad network mediation.
Mm-hmm.
And here's where it gets interesting. And to help us do that, we bought a small SSP called LiftDNA.
Right.
And LiftDNA had been working on some really interesting technology to help drive competition in the ad server. And that was what we turned into header bidding. So the way that they had been driving competition in the DFP was to find a way to put bids into the header of the page and then inject those through key value pairs into the ad server.
Mm-hmm.
We're like, oh, that's a really interesting idea. So this is one of those great examples of, you know, sometimes with acquisitions, you don't get what you expect in a bad way. And sometimes you get like a real nice surprise. So they just, it was a kernel of idea. It was still a hack.
Yeah. Cool.
And then in 2013 and 2014, we started to kind of productize that a little bit more. And so it was, you know, I know a variety of people claim that they were first and header bidder, so I won't do that. But, you know, we were certainly early in doing that. And it, you know, it was a really interesting approach. And obviously, you asked about how the market evolved. That was a big evolution.
That was the big one in a way that some people said, well, this is an existential problem for the SSP category. They don't really have a reason to exist anymore with header bidding.
Not really, because, you know, there's still some very, very vital functions.
It turned out not to be true.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's so many vital functions that the exchange performs for buyers, right? Think about the inventory aggregation function. Think about access control. Think about the quality functions that we just talked about. Think about acting as a clearinghouse, providing identity and value signal. There are so many things that really are super important, and there's still lots and lots of room to innovate on those. So, so yeah, I mean, you know, we have heard several times over the course of our lifetime, you know, these sort of like, it's all over, right? I mean, even when we started, people were like, why are you getting into this business? You're going to, DFP and AdX is going to eat the world.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, here we are now partnering with AdX.
Right, right. Well, they did eat the world, but then there's the moon. You guys can live
on. Here's the thing, they pushed it a little bit too far, right? And DFP and AdX was a closed system that, you know, was inherently advantaged, and header bidding grew up out of that, back to that first principle. Publishers want to make more money.
Okay.
And they saw that by modifying the way the system worked and using a header bidder, one at first, that they could make more money.
Mm-hmm.
And that forced, you know, them to open up the ecosystem to allow for more competition.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it's a really interesting sort of case study in how the underlying needs of a customer can change an industry structure.
Definitely. Talk a little bit, if you will, about the business side.
Yeah, sure.
What do you share publicly on metrics?
Yeah, so we shared some numbers earlier this year about last year, which was that we did $172 million. In revenue, and that grown, you know, accelerated throughout the year. I think we exited about a 20% run rate. And this year, a lot, you know, we're continuing to focus, you know, obviously on the traditional, if you like, core business, but really heavily focusing on app and video and the intersection of those two.
Mm-hmm.
And those are growing very quickly. Mobile is now more than half of our business. Which is great. And we're really excited about some of the new mobile video products we're bringing out. For example, a product we call Opt-in Video, which is essentially taking the rewarded video model and expanding it even further outside of predominantly gaming into a wider variety of different apps where you can still create a sort of incentive alignment between the consumer and the app developer. And the early data is terrific, right?
Mm.
Because completion rates are very high. So advertisers are getting their messages exposed to users. And users like the format a lot. It's one of the highest ranked ad formats because there's an element of control and participation in the experience. So we're really excited about that.
Okay, great.
I think that's got a lot of potential for the industry more broadly as well.
Mm-hmm. Great. And video, we'll come back to that. Yeah, I did want to talk more about that. But just staying on business, one of the narratives in, with the exchanges over the last couple of years has been fee pressure.
Yes.
As a result, partly of header bidding, but also just pushback from publishers as well as the buy side on what's perceived as like bloated fees. And also a bit of a price war. That, as I understand the marketplace, and I'm not an expert on this, but
AppNexus
was partly responsible for sort of driving a price war among the exchange platforms. And they now have been acquired, of course, by AT&T. Do you see relief on the horizon in terms of like margins for your competitive set? Or will it just be, squeeze in the years to come?
It really is a question of value, right? The way we try and think about it is, what value do we create for our clients? And if we can create value, we should be able to participate in some derivative way for that. So we've always tried to link how we price, and we price in a very simple way. We charge our publishers a rev share. It's a specific contract with each one of those. The rates do vary widely. We've never charged the buy side anything. I've kept it very, very simple. And so it's been a relatively easy model to explain, and we haven't kind of fallen into any of these kind of issues that some others have charging both sides and all that stuff.
Okay.
But I do think that as an industry grows and to some extent consolidates, it is natural that rev shares come down, right? And we've seen that, and we expect to continue to see that. I think sometimes there's an expectation that the fees should be exceptionally low, and I don't know if that's realistic, given all the things that either a DSP or an exchange needs to do to provide value to the clients, to expect them to get paid a very small amount of money. I think there's a reasonable range, and we'll have to see where that settles in over the next year or two. For players that are providing true value, right? Take that example of, doing all of that work on quality, right? It costs money, right? It costs $25 million. So do you want us to do that work? Because it seems like it's very important that that you get quality, you get trust, and you get transparency, you get all those different things.
Yeah, right. Well,
so I think, all
on the
us,
buy side, I mean, buyers are very demanding in this industry.
Yep.
And I think there's an issue, frankly, with marketers who want the very best but aren't willing to pay for it necessarily. They still want those sweet, cheap CPMs, which are widely available if they're willing to look the other way on quality.
You just got to make sure that we try and educate people as best we can about what's real, what isn't. I mean, for example, if you think you're getting premium video inventory for a $2.50 CPM, well, it is probably not what you think it is, right? And there are just some realities that need to be addressed.
Mm-hmm. In terms of the addressable market for you and the kind of the landscape of publishers that are healthy, strong and digital and have a scaled audience, what's happening to that sort of?
Well, it's
the one of the narratives you hear if you read the trades is it's hard times in publisher land, and certainly there are companies that are stressed.
No question, right? I mean, I think that's been true, and it started with print getting pressure, and then it moved into. But I think there's still a very vibrant ecosystem of independent publishers on the web and independent app developers in the mobile app space. And they cross the gamut from more traditional guys to very video-oriented. And they also, when you start to look internationally, those markets are, growing and flourishing. So when, I think the classic debate is Google and Facebook going to eat the world and it's all consumer attention going to get aggregated there? Right. That's sort of the depending on which stocks you're invested in, that's one scenario, right? We feel that there is a big chunk, I don't know whether it's 30% of activity or 35% of consumer activity that occurs on folks who aren't them. And when you take that and apply that to the global market, it's a very large market.
Okay.
And it's continuing to innovate and diversify in some really interesting ways that require new ad products, right? That require technology-based systems with new ad products that work in those environments. So, we have you know, when I look at our roadmap, for example, I'm not feeling like we're bored. There isn't a lot of stuff to work on.
Okay. Right?
There's a lot of stuff to work on mm-hmm. that can help these folks monetize their audience more effectively and create a more relevant experience.
Do you have the cash you need to do it?
I think we do, yeah. Okay. I mean, we it's been a long time. We raised, last had to raise capital for it's over 5 years ago. And we've grown every year for the 10 years and we've been profitable for the last four. So, you know, I think we're in good shape.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's go back to AppNexus going to AT&T.
Sure.
Because that was a big deal in the yep. small world of mm-hmm. ad tech. Mm-hmm. It was sparked by a much bigger deal mm-hmm. in the larger world of media and telco.
Yep.
Obviously, AT&T buying Time Warner enabled this smaller transaction to take
Absolutely.
Place.
Yeah.
And there's a sense that a lot of companies have been waiting. You know, there are a lot of big deals still pending.
Yep.
The thing is going to play out with 21st Century Fox and Comcast or Disney.
Yeah. Yep.
But clearly there's this kind of looming competitive sort of battle. I don't want to say battle. I hate casting everything in terms of war.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
But like, you know, but you know, like
struggle.
There are tech, yeah. to use like a phrase that Terry Kawaja just shared on the podcast a couple weeks ago. There are tectonic changes happening mm-hmm. in media and mm-hmm. telco.
Yes.
And cable.
Yeah.
And that they those have kind of follow-on effects
yeah.
For advertising technology. Yeah. So one of these is AppNexus gets acquired mm-hmm, by mm-hmm, AT&T. Mm-hmm. There may be others to come. Yeah,
well,
what do you think is going to happen? Are big media companies going to acquire more exchanges? Well,
there are some we chatted about this a few weeks ago, I think, mm-hmm. but there's some fundamentals at play, right? So what Terry, I think, is referring to is more companies are becoming media companies along with other things, which means that, you know, they're not just selling access to wireless or, you know, other kinds of services, they're becoming a media company.
Mm-hmm.
And media companies have a couple of choices for business models. They can get subscriptions or they can do advertising or they can do both. And a lot of these folks are saying advertising is probably going to be an important part of my business going forward. And because I'm in media, increasingly the user is using my media experience through a digital mechanism. So I need a way to monetize an increasingly large amount of media attention in a digital model. So I need a monetization engine, right? I need a company or a capability, a technology that allows me to monetize that at scale. And a lot of these companies, that's not their DNA, right? So what do you do then? There's plenty of examples, you know, all the way dating back to the earlier stage of the internet. I'll
sure.
go through a couple.
Right, but media going to Yahoo.
Yeah, well, you know, Yahoo buying Overture. That's a search monetization engine, mm-hmm. right? Or
right.
Yahoo buying Right Media. That's a display monetization engine,
mm-hmm.
right? Those are two great examples.
Sure.
Big media company needs that monetization engine. Now, independent monetization engines are always built on third-party distribution. So what do I mean by that? It means that they don't have any of their owned and operated properties. They don't have their own audience. AppNexus didn't have a consumer relationship. We don't. We build the companies to monetize other people's inventory. And then big media company comes along like, hey, I've got a lot of media. I'm going to have more. I need to connect a monetization engine to that.
Right.
To help me make that money.
I need one of those.
I need that engine, right?
Are Disney and Viacom and these kinds of companies going to look over there,
I think
see what AT&T,
you know,
is doing and be like, I need one of those? And
look,
then,
have you been
getting calls?
It's hard to forecast exactly what's
yeah.
going to happen, but
yeah,
I have
yeah.
seen this cycle play out over mm-hmm. 15, 18 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be logical for a number of big media companies to start saying, you know, I need a monetization engine. I probably agree that programmatic, a technology-based trading of advertising is going to be a really important part of the
mm-hmm.
puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a capability I should at least be looking at.
For some time, it's been gospel among the exchanges that you got to serve the publisher only.
Mm-hmm.
I think you guys have been pretty consistent in serving the publisher. Index is another one that I think has been strongly publisher-focused. AppNexus has often played both directions, but they're mostly known as an exchange platform.
Yeah, like let me just, I think there's an important clarification here, which
okay.
is, you know, we and our peers, we run two-sided marketplaces, right? Which means there are buyers and there's sellers.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, you know, we've typically or historically talked about the publisher as our customer,
mm-hmm.
but the buyer is also our customer as well. We often talk about DSPs, for example, as our partners,
mm-hmm.
because our value proposition to the publisher doesn't work if the DSPs, the agencies, and the advertisers aren't super happy and participating and, mm-hmm. and spending aggressively and have trust, and that's why
mm-hmm.
we do things like quality. So you need both sides of the marketplace. So unlike a lot of businesses where you have one customer,
mm-hmm.
we have two,
mm-hmm.
right? And we've got to keep both of them happy. I'll give you an example. So if you were to run a system that extracted overly high prices from an advertiser, you can maybe do that for a little bit, but over time, they're like, that's not working for me because it's not driving a return on investment of my ad spend. And so I'm going to spend less there over time. So mm-hmm. to be sustainable and to grow over the kind of time periods that we're talking about and into the future, you've got to do a great job
yeah.
on both sides. And think about that quality investment.
Mm-hmm. Like
a lot of that is going into quality for the buyer,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Even though we don't have a fee-paying relationship with them, the yeah. money comes from them and it goes to the publisher. So it's
right.
an interesting kind of way of thinking about the two sides of the business.
Right. Do you think we'll see even more convergence of demand and supply within a single platform?
I think it's possible. I think there are.
Would you be shocked to learn that?
I wouldn't be shocked.
DataXu and Rubicon were merging?
I don't know about any. I mean, thematically, I wouldn't be shocked. So look, there are pros and cons, right?
Well, obviously AT&T is going to use both AppNexus's DSP as well as
yeah.
the SSP.
Now, look,
they're both going to play a role.
Once you are applying the monetization engine that you now own
mm-hmm.
to your own owned and operated assets, you know, it's just you want as unified a pipe as you can. Of course, it's what Facebook and Google do,
yeah.
right? They, mm-hmm. they own the monetization engine. It's a single pipe. Everything goes through their systems.
Mm-hmm.
Boom,
mm-hmm.
done. And if you're a big player, and that's what you're asking, like how many other big players are there
mm-hmm.
where they say, you know, this is so strategic to me that I shouldn't rent this technology.
Yeah.
I should own it.
Mm-hmm.
And if I want to own it, should I build it? Or should I buy it and then build on top? Because it's always buy and build. It's never buy and you're done, right? There's a lot
right.
of work to be done.
Of course.
Mm-hmm. So no, I wouldn't be shocked. There's good and bad things about that, right? When you serve, sit in that market and you have the objective function is driving yield while keeping the buy side happy. That's a little simpler. If you're running on the buy side at the same time, you have a little bit more balancing to do.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And also from just prosaically, from a product roadmap point of view, if you are building and running an exchange and a DSP at the same time, it's a lot more work.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
And you got to like have the teams and have the ability to kind of manage on more tracks. And mm-hmm. that, it's complicated. That's why, you know, Brian, the AppNexus team was a big team. Right.
Like, yes.
I forget the exact number, but, you know, it was a lot of people to
right.
do that.
Right. All right, terrific. One more very kind of wonky in the weeds question for you before
oh, yeah.
we wrap. First price auction.
Yeah.
It's been a real trend. And,
it has.
You know, and I'm just curious if you could give an update on.
Yeah. So
do you still see that progressing?
I do. So just a little bit of context on that. So we saw that happening earlier last year. And we saw that prices were what was called 100% paid to bid, where it's basically a first price auction, i.e. what the advertiser was paying was what they bid. But it wasn't always being fully disclosed that was what was happening. And that worried us because, and going back to this two-sided marketplace, it's really important to keep the buyers happy and to ensure that they understand what game they're playing. And so this fits right into transparency. Being clear as to how the bidding system works. So we went out last fall, it's right around DeMexico, September, and we released a transparent first price auction, which meant that in every bid request in the open RTB spec, we would tell the DSP, this is a first price auction or a second price auction. So it's completely clear. And they could then adapt their algorithms because bidding on a first price is different.
Different strategy.
It's actually quite yeah. a lot harder.
Mm-hmm.
And we also did a third thing, which was we gave them time. We said to each DSP, this is a big change. how, you know, how fast do you want to do it? You tell us how quickly you want to ramp into first price auctions versus second price auctions. And so we kind of gave them some control there, which obviously they liked, and that's good partnership. So now I gave you that to give you kind of a sense of the historical context a little bit. Now at this point, we're fairly well ramped up on first price auctions, which we use when we're competing in a container, which is when essentially where we are competing with other exchanges.
Mm-hmm.
That's typically where we use it. And it's, you know, the majority of our auctions at this point are first price auctions.
Okay. Wow. Interesting. Yeah. More than I thought you'd say. Yeah. So
that's where we're at. So, you know, that's a great example of the evolution of the space. And I anticipate there will be probably some more shifts in the way auction theory works.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll have you back to talk about them.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming.
You're
into
welcome.
The studio.
It was great. Yeah. Thank you.
Good conversation.
You bet.
And thank you, listener, for tuning in. We'll see you next week.
Produced by Bigfoot Music and Sound in New York City.